My name is Tom Torrey, and I'm here with Merritt Bomer Bateman. The date is May 28th, and we're here in Sydney. Okay, perhaps we could begin with you telling us where and when you were born.
Well, I was born in 1919 in the month of May in the little town of Quion, Q-U-I-O-N, which is just on the north side of the Ottawa River, above Ottawa, about 20 or so miles above Ottawa.
Does your family have any military experiences?
No. There wasn't really any military experience. My father was had come out from England in 1905 or something, and was well into his later years when I came along. I know my mother was about 42 or 43 years of age when I was born. So there was no involvement of the family to my knowledge. Ancestrally, I suppose I had one uncle, I think, several uncles who were involved in the Boer War and in the Great War. But other than that, there was no, to my knowledge.
When did you get involved with the military?
Well, I went to Bishop's University, and while I was there in 37, 38, and 39, I became involved in the Canadian Officers Training Contingent. And in that, there I qualified. I had my, what they call a certificate, A or B, whatever it was, which entitled me to be commissioned as a lieutenant in the infantry. There was only two things you could choose. You could either choose the artillery or the infantry. There was no other course open to you as a cadet, so I became an infantryman.
Did you think that war was likely at this time when you entered?
Well, yes. I think everyone began to think that the war was inevitable about 1937. At that time, I became a sapper in the Royal Canadian Engineers in my hometown of Thetford Mines, where I lived at the time. And while just about the same time, I started off at university. And while I continued on as a sapper in the Royal Canadian Engineers, I was taking my COTC training at Bishop's.
And where were you when war broke out? You were in university?
I was in university, and I was in May or June, I think it was June probably, of 1940, when the British were having to withdraw from Dunkirk. My class, which consisted of some 60 or 65 people, were of course very upset at the time. We had a principal who was an Englishman, and of course he was all for England and that sort of thing, and he roused everyone up to such an extent that really I think something like 80% of the class joined the army in the summer of 1940, immediately after they got out of university.
Is that right?
Yes.
And were they all with you, and what were you?
Oh, no, because there was a half a dozen or so that joined the Sherbrooke Regiment, called the Sherbrooke Fusilier Regiment, which was just formed in the summer of 1940. And of course, I went to university at Bishop's, so we were only 4 or 5 miles away, and I knew a lot of the people involved, and most of us, or half a dozen of us anyway, joined that regiment.
And what sort of training would you have had at this time?
Well, I don't know whether you know what COTC training is like, but it's sort of one parade a week sort of idea, and you really don't learn an awful lot about being a soldier, so that you learn a lot of theoretical stuff, and the practical aspects of it were marching a platoon up and down on a parade square, back and forth, and as long as you could do that and your voice was loud enough so that they could hear you, you qualified. This didn't really make you an officer and a gentleman at all.
But when you emerged from the COTC, you were a second lieutenant?
I was a second lieutenant. I joined the Sherbrooke Fusilier Regiment in the summer of 1940 as a second lieutenant. And I retained that rank, I think it was, for 3 months. And so long as you were acceptable to the regiment and to the commanding officer of the regiment, and on his say-so, you got your second pip, or you became a lieutenant. And so I was promoted to lieutenant probably around October, November, I suppose, of 1940.
What was your pay as a second lieutenant compared to a lieutenant?
Well, it wasn't very much different, I don't think. I think, as I recall, a second lieutenant's pay was about $1.25 a day, and a lieutenant's pay was about $1.50 a day. So an extra 25 cents a day, which was the... Mm-hmm. That was a lot of money. Oh, yeah, a big deal.
So was it about this time that you marched to Ottawa?
No, we spent the winter. The regiment was stationed at the Canadian National Exhibition Grounds in Sherbrooke. And they had converted a lot of the cattle barns into accommodation for the battalion. Of course, an infantry battalion rather than an armored regiment. And so we lived for the winter of 1940 into the spring of 41. And it was in the spring of 41, after having spent a rather miserable winter.
Tell me about that. What were the conditions like?
Well, the conditions weren't very good. The cattle barns we lived in, where it had been converted, and they had put flooring in and that sort of thing, but that did prevent the smells of the years and years of cattle housing from coming out of the building, so that you woke up in the morning and felt you'd been in a barn, in a real barn all night. It was but one big long row, and all the officers of the regiment, some 30 officers, there were no cubicles or anything, which is one bed after another, and we were all lined up in there in this one room. As a mess, we had a sort of room which overlooked the indoor skating rink, which was used by the Sherbrooke Hockey Club. That was our mess. Many of the buildings which were used for a display and that sort of thing at an exhibition were where the men were quartered, which was the same sort of idea. It wasn't a very happy year. We were very cold, very miserable. It was a terrible winter, I can recall, and the only real training we got in that winter was on the ranges, and there was a local range which were used by the local firing club, which we were permitted to use. And I can remember spending hours and day after day down on those ranges firing the old Ross rifle, which was a World War I rifle, and being so miserably cold because we had no... There was no proper clothing at all. You had a greatcoat which you had to buy yourself, and you had no proper footwear or anything like that. The winters were very, very cold.
What did they provide in the way of uniforms?
Well, they provided, I guess it was the very beginning of the battle dress. Some of the men had these uniforms which were World War I uniforms when I first arrived at the regiment, but very quickly, and I can't recall the time here, the original battle dress arrived about that time in the sort of fall of 1940. Uniforms which officers wore, of course, everyone had to buy their own uniform. You were given an allowance of $150, and with that you were required to pay for your uniform, pay for your greatcoat, pay for your special shoes you had to wear, the whole kit and caboodle. But it was a very miserable and cold winter.
Was there much in the way of social life or sports?
None.
Nothing at all?
There was the odd regimental. We used to run the odd battalion sports meets between companies. But it was in the winter time. There was very little opportunity for that. And in the spring, when the snow began to melt, at about that time we were told that we were going to move to march to Connaught Ranges, which are just arranged just outside the city of Ottawa. So from about a month or so before we left, we had compulsory marching, route marches, which we were on every day for 4 and 5 and 6 hours, training to so that we could head off and not half of us drop out before we got to Ottawa.
How was the actual march?
It was fine. We went in a very... It was the march was twofold. the purpose was twofold. We were to, A, we were coming to Connaught Ranges to do some rifle firing and machine gun firing, and it's a proper range. The second purpose, undoubtedly because of the route that we took, which was a very zigzag route, I think the distance between Sherbrooke and Ottawa is not more than about 250 miles. But the route we took, which was really sort of from Sherbrooke south to the American border, up again to St. John's, Quebec, down again to Sweetsburg, through up and up to Montreal, really it must have been over close to 400 miles by the time we... And the purpose of that was to sell war bonds, Canadian war bonds. And every town, every little village that we came to, the whole regiment would concertina meet, because the companies marked separately from each other. Then they'd meet and get all tarted up and get you polished up and your shoes polished and this sort of thing. And the band would arrive from somewhere, which we had a battalion band. They would be trucked in and we'd march through this town, no matter how big it was. And this was in order to spread the word and try and sell war bonds. An interesting aside on these marches in that part of the province of Quebec. On several occasions, we marched through town without seeing one person, not one single person. Whether or not it was the attitude to the war, which I'm sure it was at that time, or whether it was fear of some kind that we were going to recruit out there to recruit the young men of the village or something, sort of the old press gang that the Royal Navy used to use, the old idea. I don't know, but I know there were some villages, which I can't recall the names of. Not a soul, not even women. The odd child, perhaps, who was interested in the music, but not a soul. And it was rather an eye-opener to all of us that such a thing could happen.
What were you thinking?
Well. Everyone was aware of the fact that the Quebecois wasn't very interested in fighting war for what he said the war for England, what he called the war for England. He hadn't read his newspaper very carefully because obviously it was more for France than it was for England at that time in 1940. Anyway, it left one sort of numb a bit, I think, and one felt as though the whole thing was a bit pointless.
How long did you spend at Connaught Ranges?
Very short time. On arrival at the Connaught Ranges, where under company control, we were out on the ranges every day for a number of weeks, a couple of weeks anyway, and we were told just about that time that we were going to go to Hong Kong. At least that was the word that went around. We weren't told officially, I don't think, but I think that no doubt about it was quite true. Because just about after we'd been there for three weeks, perhaps, the Minister of National Defense, who was a man called Ralston, came to visit us. And we were told by him that we were not going to go overseas, as we may have gathered, but that we were going to go to Newfoundland. And the regiment, the battalion, two battalions in Newfoundland, the Royal Rifles of Quebec and the Winnipeg Rifles, were taken out of Newfoundland, and they're the ones who ended up going to Hong Kong, and we went to Newfoundland.
And you were quite lucky.
Well, as it turned out, we were very disappointed at the time because we were all gung-ho, and you know, we all wanted to get involved because that's what we joined up for. And as it turned out, of course, we were very fortunate because they didn't last very long. I think Christmas of 41 saw the end of them, and so it would have been a very short holiday for us.
So it was mostly practice at this time?
Practice
firing.
And the grenade ranges and rifle ranges and machine gun ranges. And about then, too, I guess, we were given the Lee Enfield rifle, which was an old rifle too, but also a World War I rifle. See, the Ross rifle went back to the Boer War, even before the Boer War. That's what we were issued originally. It was very heavy. Oh, gosh, it must have weighed 40 pounds or more. One of these things. The Enfield weighed about 9 pounds. Much more reliable. And we were delighted, of course, to receive that. And we also, at the same time, I might add, received the Bren gun. Up until then, we'd done our training on the Lewis machine gun. We received the Bren gun, and we were doing a machine gun firing with the Bren gun, and that's the first time we'd seen one. I think we had one per company or something like that, rather than one per platoon, which we ended up with eventually. Is this machine a recording, you think,
Oliver? It is, yes.
Okay.
Okay, and when would you have gone to Newfoundland?
Well, it would probably have been in the month of August. Of August or September of 41, something like that. We traveled by train from Ottawa to Halifax, and from there, Halifax, we got on a boat, the whole battalion together, and we went and we arrived in Newfoundland at the port of St. John's sometime in early September. And we were stationed at what was called Lester's Field, which was of great interest to me personally, not at the time, but later, because it was from Lester's Field that my father-in-law made his first attempt to fly the Atlantic Ocean back in 1919. And they still had there the undercarriage of this aircraft, which they when they took off, once they got in the air, they let it drop. The undercarriage fell on the land, so they wouldn't have to carry the extra weight across the Atlantic. And so it was left. That was the same field where I ended up in St. John.
Well, were you stationed in the H huts then?
Did you have they had H huts. Yes, St. John's had been occupied, as I said, by I guess the Royal Rifles occupied were at St. John. And the Winnipeg Rifles were up in Gander. And I think they had changed. They had gone from one, they alternated, because St. John, of course, was the better place to be, because there was a bit of social life and nightlife, whereas Gander was pretty much a disaster, I guess.
And are we in the winter of 1941 here?
Yeah. We arrived there in September of 41, and we were there from until, I guess, the Americans got into the war in 42, in 41, didn't they? The Pearl Harbor bit was in December 41. So we were there for that.
And you were changed this time from infantry to...
No, we were still infantry.
You were still infantry?
Oh, yeah, we were infantry then. And the jobs then were, of course... We had great defensive plans for for Newfoundland, which was supposed to be attacked by German submarines, and we used to go out to the various outports, take our platoon with us, go out for a week or 10 days at a time, and you'd sit at this outport with guards out during the winter months, sleet and rain and hail, and you never saw anything like it, all night long, where it was impossible for anyone to land. But we, I forgot the name of the places we were. Petty Harbor was one, on Conception Bay, which was the large bay in which we saw, in fact, a number of German submarines come into Conception Bay and go to these small outports for food, and they would go in and literally obtain food from the locals. Who didn't know them from Adam, of course, and these bellows would put on their civilian clothes, and they always had one or two guys who could talk English, and they'd go in, they'd buy local food and fresh fruit and this sort of stuff, and then they'd go back into the submarine in the bay, and that would be it. And this was happening all the time, at that time, at the beginning of the in the 19 late in the 40-41 period. We left Newfoundland. The regiment stayed in Newfoundland, but all of the subalterns. Then, in about January of 42, we left Newfoundland, and we were sent to Camp Borden, 18 of us, because the regiment at that time, the decision was made to convert the regiment from an infantry battalion to an armored regiment. And we became, at that time, the 27th Armored Regiment. Sherbert Fusiliers, 27th Armored Regiment. We went to Camp Borden, where we started to take training in wireless, in tank maintenance, and in the gunnery, tank gunnery. We were there for a very short time.
Were there any tanks?
Well, that's the point. They had a few ram tanks in Camp Borden, which was the Canadian tank, which was produced in Canada. They had a few of those. They had a couple of old Renaults, which was World War I thing, and the sort of thing that they'd bought from the Americans or something. And so the training was very, you know, almost... Well, we had a bit of practical training. We never got any gun, firing of any guns or anything like that. We were only there about a month. Perhaps less than that. And the decision was made that since the training was so basic, that we would be sent to England. So this whole group of young, I've forgotten whether it was 16 or 18 officers, all subalterns, and the equivalent number of NCOs were sent to England. So that we arrived in England in, I suppose toward the end of February, April, late March, early April, I guess. Of 42. The regiment was still, or just about this time, the regiment left Newfoundland and ended up in De Burt, Nova Scotia. And there they were being converted to an armored regiment in a very slow sort of process. I don't know I don't know what happened during that period. We, in the meantime, were being trained as troop leaders in the tank regiment and troop sergeants. And then once we had our training, this was a prolonged sort of 16 weeks.
Where was this?
A place called Blackdown, which is right near the guard depot. Just outside, maybe not more than 15, 20 miles from Aldershot. And not far from Sandhurst, not far from Camberley, where the equivalent, maybe 4 or 5 miles from Camberley. And after about 16 weeks of training, we had about 4 weeks. Oh, 4 or 6 weeks of training on gunnery and wireless, D&M, so that we all became instructors in each one of these subjects. Then when the regiment then arrived over in the summer of 1942 to England, then we rejoined our regiment and, of course, were then able to carry out instruction and teach the people the things that we had learned. The tactics side, there were troop tactics, gunnery, D&M, and wireless. 4 weeks in each. I'm sure it was about 4 weeks in each course.
And then?
Then we were in Aldershot at that time, and the regiment, when it was in De Burt, became a part of the 4th Canadian Armored Division. And the 4th Canadian Armored Division, when it came overseas in the summer of 42, our regiment came with them. We were with the regiment. I was with the regiment then, ending my training at Blackdown until the fall of 42. And then it was decided the whole thing would be reorganized. And the 4th Armored Division, instead of having two armored brigades, ended up with one armored brigade and a motor battalion, which were transported in half-track sort of thing. We then became part of the 2nd Independent Armored Brigade. So we left 4 Division and went to the 2nd Independent Armored Brigade, and we joined in there with what was the 1st Hussars and the Fort Garry Horse. They had been I don't know where they came, whether they were part of the 2nd Brigade of 4th Armored Division or not. I think they were. My memory fails me. I think they were, because they had two armored brigades. They ended up with one, and we went with them, and we became an independent brigade to support infantry divisions. So we could support, rather than be tied to one particular division, as an independent brigade, we could be put under command or in support of an infantry division, either the 2nd or the 3rd infantry divisions at there. So we were able to give them armored support in that way.
And you were finally getting some practical training, some quality.
In England, we first arrived. We were issued with, we had some General Lee tanks. We had some ram. We had ram tanks for a long, long time. Mm-hmm.
Sherman's.
And then eventually, just about a very short time before D-Day, we got our Sherman tanks.
And with each tank, you'd have to know it inside out. And
each tank was a little. The Sherman and the ram weren't that different, really. The guns were different. The Sherman had a 75 and the ram had a 6-pounder. Some of them had 2-pounders. The original ones had 2-pounders, and they converted those to 6-pounders. The Sherman tank had a 75. And then they also, Sherman tank, was given what was called a Firefly. The Firefly was a 17-pounder tank. Very long-barreled, high-velocity weapon, which we needed simply to fight the enemy tank, because the 75 against the German tank was really quite hopeless. And we had to have some weapon, although the tank is not an anti-tank vehicle, as a lot of people seem to think today, and this is the way they're looking at tanks. They're not, and they should never look at them that way. Tanks are not anti-tank vehicles, mobile vehicles. Their tanks are there for the sole support of infantry, to help assist infantry to move from A to B. But obviously you're going to run into enemy tanks, and as a secondary role, the tank then should be able to engage enemy tanks. Well, the 75-pounder, which we had, was useless. It was a tremendous weapon to support infantry because it had a high, low velocity and a high trajectory. And the high explosive round was a very good round, and it covered a good territory when you used it. but it was useless. It was the armor-piercing round that we had was useless against tanks. So each troop of our regiment was issued with what they call a Firefly, which was a 17-pounder. They gave it the nickname Firefly, I suppose, so that to try and cover up the idea that we had them. Although these things were the barrels, Chrysler's from here to the 5 feet beyond the wall over there, you know, it's tremendously long thing. And it was one of the very first guns which we had developed in the British and Canadian armies, with a high velocity. It wasn't such a high velocity round, it was about 3,300 feet per second. But it had a 17-pounder solid shot. And you can imagine the 3,300 feet per second with 17-pounder gun weapon. The momentum of such a round was very great. Mm-hmm. As compared to 75, the shot weighed maybe 8 pounds and had a velocity of about 2,200 feet per second. So its momentum would be very, very low. So each troop had one of these things. So we had, and that was when we moved then from a troop of three to a troop of four. And the fourth tank became the Firefly tank. And it was there really to engage enemy armor, whereas the other three were in support for the support of the infantry, which we were with.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about social life in England, and what would have been your daily routine while in this in Aldershot?
We were in Aldershot for a very short time. We left Aldershot in the winter of 42, 43. We were only there for about 6 months in Aldershot. And we went down to a little village called Headley. And really the things that we did, that was in the South Downs of England, just north of the South Downs of England. The South Downs were ideal for tank training because they're very wide open and fairly hilly, in fact quite hilly, and you could travel anywhere. The downs were really just chalk cliffs, and so that there wasn't very much agriculture taking place on, so you weren't destroying farmers' fields and this sort of thing. So we used them for tactical training, and this is really the first time. We had our tanks then, we had ram tanks then, but we then were able to do a lot of tactical troop and squadron tactical training in the Headley area, just south of Headley. And that's really where we began then to bring the troops and the squadrons and the regiment really coming together as a tactical unit. And we did a lot of training there. Having left that then, we went to Worthing. And this was the time when there was an awful lot of talk of German invasion of England. So we ended up on the beaches, literally, of the area of between Worthing and Brighton. And the whole regiment, almost literally, strung out. And of course, a tank weapon would be very good weapon against landing craft of any kind. So we were there for, my dates are getting all mixed up here, but I'm sure we were there in the, say, the summer, late summer of 42, of, 42, in the winter of 43. And in the spring of 43, we really had an active role, you might say, in the defense of the coast at that time. And we were there for quite a while.
That was your main function?
That was the main function, but we did a lot of training. There was only one squadron, I think, deployed at any one time. That were the other two squadrons. Then the downs were north of us then. So we did a lot of our training there and our range firing and that sort of thing. Actual range firing with infantry and, you know, firing in close cooperation with infantry with them on the ground and shooting over their heads and this sort of stuff. So it was all very good stuff that we were doing. We left then there, having done a number of exercises. We weren't involved in Tiger, but we were involved in a large army exercise called Spartan and that sort of thing.
What would have that entail?
Oh, traveling all over the place. We traveled from one side of England to the other, as far north as Wales, and back again. An advance to contact exercise, day after day, so that by the end of it, you were just exhausted. You'd go for 4 and 5 days without any sleep at all, you know, hardly. We left from there, and we ended up in on the south coast of England, the other side of the New Forest, south of the New Forest, the other side of Southampton, between Southampton and Bournemouth. And the squadrons were divided up. We were in a little village called Highcliff, which was right on the coast again, doing this coastal role again, but way further to the west. Had another squadron was in New Milton, and another squadron was in somewhere else. So that we were all confined to that area. The reason for that, I would think, was that this is where they then began to deploy us, and prepare us to leave from Southampton for the landings in France. And I'm sure this is why we moved to that area, so that our march from there to the boats was very simple and very easy and done very quickly.
Do you think the training prepared you for D-Day?
No doubt about it. We did, I don't know how many seaborne exercises while we were in that area. I can't remember the names, but we went up to Wales. We did an exercise at in Wales. We did an exercise in Scotland at Rothsay and Dunoon. We did exercises. The name just amazing how on the south coast of England, Studland Bay, not far from where we were. We did a tremendous exercise there, and some of our carriers, we were then boarding and disembarking from the very craft that we would use on D-Day. So that when D-Day eventually came, really it was another exercise.
Okay.
It was really, the training was such that, and we'd go out to sea, and we'd spend 3 and 4 days at sea, then come ashore, and simulating an attack on a beach, or a beachhead.
Let's talk about D-Day. If you could give me your experience from the whole day here.
Well, D-Day is a great muddle as far as I'm concerned. We left from Southampton Water. We were supposed to leave on the 4th of June. We didn't leave till the night of the 5th of June.
Because of the weather?
Because of the weather, and we were delayed. The crossing was just an atrocious thing. The landing craft, which I was in, was one of the, it was a Mark IV craft, and it had a sunken tank deck, and there must have been 2 or 3 feet of water in that deck. Everybody was sick. I never saw such a bunch of sick people in my life. We cut off the shore of France very early on the morning of the 6th of June, and we didn't really land. I didn't get my tank on the ground until around noon, because of the delays in clearing the mines, because of the delays of the two brigades in front of us in getting through to the getting any depth to create a little bridgehead. It was around noon before we got ashore, but although we were all decked out with waterproofing and stuff, we landed almost dry shot.
Well, let's talk about that, the floating tanks.
Well, the two regiments, the 1st Hussars and the Fort Garry's had the floating tank.
They went in before you.
They went in ahead of time. We were all waterproofed. We had the great funnel sticking out so that when you went below the water, you had air intake and exit, which you always did when you went into the water from the craft because of the angle of descent. Very often, you see these craft, all the shore on Normandy was what they called a tremendous number of sand runnels from the action of the water, the waves and the tides. And when you hit a drift, as it were, of sand, the craft would stop against it. So if the craft had a draft of 4 feet, then the top of that runnel would be 4 feet high or higher. Unfortunately, the other side of the drift would be a hole. So when you went out of these things, you'd go down, and sometimes you'd go down 8, 9, 10 feet. And as a result, many of the tanks were drowned, and we lost some of them.
16?
Well, not in our regiment. No, in the 1st Hussars, I believe, lost 16 of their 18 or 19 tanks were drowned. Now, this was because they were floating ashore. They went to sea, something that's like 2 and 3 miles or more, perhaps, out at sea. And they were the dual drive tanks. And they were the ones who were swamped. Although we lost some of our swamp because some of the craft would land on these runnels, hit a runnel, and then go into the water and drown the engine.
What would you have seen when you first landed on the beach?
Well, we had of course done sand exercises day after day after day using bogus maps so that although most of us had figured out exactly where we were going to land, theoretically, the bogus map would have kept us in the dark so that we wouldn't want to be talking about it. But there was no doubt about it. When we came, we landed at a place called Beni, and I recognized immediately the outline of the town, the church, some of the major buildings, how they were situated on the beach. And I knew immediately from a couple of miles out, more than that, 3 or 4 miles out, that was our beach and that's where we were going. It was a gray, misty, miserable sort of day. The wind was still very high. It wasn't raining, but it was a great feeling of foreboding about it all. It's hard to explain, really, I suppose. When we got ashore, an awful lot of dead people lying around, which was a bit of a shock.
You hadn't expected
it? I hadn't. Well, I had expected it, but you never thought much about it, you know. And all this training we had done, although we'd had a number of people killed in the regiment, landing, boarding our craft in Southampton, for example. One of the landing craft was, we got off a hard, but the hard was a sort of a cement thing that came down off the shore, and the landing craft came up against it, and the tank came down and boarded the landing craft from the hard. Well, the boat hadn't had his engines going forward all the time, and when the tank hit the damn thing, the boat backed up, so the tank ended up in about 30 feet of water in the harbor, and the whole damn crew was drowned. But the thing that really brought the reality home was seeing these bodies lying all over the damn place on the beach and sort of bouncing around on the waves and floating upside down the waves and on the shore. And this was really the difference, I think. And if you were going to be afraid, this was the time when you began to be afraid, other than the exercise sort of approach to it that we'd had throughout England and Scotland. This was the difference. In my tank, I remember we had we had a new type of, so that we wouldn't broadcast where we were, when we were netting the wireless set to be on net with the other tanks in the troop and squadron. They had a system which they put in a little box which you could pre-net from this little box onto a given frequency. Well, mine, the people who had fitted it in to the set had connected it badly. And mine fused, and the whole damn set went out. And this was just before I was due to take off from my boat to land. So here we were, knowing I was going to go into God knows how many feet of water, you couldn't tell. I rigged up two little strings on the driver's little lapels here, down through the turret basket, onto his. So I wanted to go right, like a steering horse, and it worked fine. Because he was below the water, you see. He couldn't see because of his periscope. It would be maybe 3 or 4 feet below the water. My tank never went under the water, so I was able to see over the top. So I was able to steer him with these things until we got ashore and got our set changed. And we didn't get a change right away, but we got a change the next day.
So what was your immediate task upon landing?
Well, immediate task was to go to what they called an RV. And there to...
What was the RV?
The RV was about through the little village where each squadron had its own RV. And you went there and you disgorged your surplus ammunition. Every tank carried a total of full tank load, turret load of ammunition, plus what were called turtles. And a turtle was a sled which you could fill. You could put about, oh, I've forgotten, 110 rounds, I think it was, of 75 millimeter ammunition in this sled. And the sled was the exact width of the inside of the tracks of your tank and of the height of the bottom of the tank to the deck of the craft. When you backed, you always backed into these landing craft. When you backed in, you had this sled attached to the back of your tank. No, how did it work? I've forgotten. Anyway, you backed in, you pulled the sled up between the tracks of your tank, and there it sat under your tank. And when you took off, you pulled this sled with you. And it was this extra ammunition which we had, which every tank had an extra then 110 rounds of ammunition. And we deposited these at this RV, having got through the first little village. Then you depart. Then our trucks came ashore and picked it up. Then and eventually it came to us, I suppose, down the line somewhere. We got ashore about, I say, about 12 o'clock. We got to our RV around 1. We lost a tank by then, one or two tanks in the squadron from enemy fire.
What was the resistance like?
It wasn't too bad for us. There was a crest. There were two places. There was Beni on the shore, which is, oddly enough, was called Beni, and then inland, about a mile inland, was a place called Beni-sur-Mer. You'd think it was the other way around, but it wasn't. And at Beni-sur-Mer, there was a number of German anti-tank weapons, and I can remember seeing the first one. They had a long barrel 75, and their anti-tank gun was built so that the gun was right on top of the carriage and recoil mechanism and the whole thing, so that when you put it in the ground, the only thing that showed, if you could see it, was the barrel. Mm-hmm. There was no long superstructure. There was no high superstructure around this weapon at all. And you just couldn't see those damn things. And except when they fired, of course. And being so close to the ground, the barrel was so close to the ground that the blast from the muzzle blast, created one hell of a lot of dust. And of course, that's what gave them away. That's what gave them away.
And then you would aim.
That's right. That's what gave them away, this great amount of dust which came up, because the barrel was so close to the ground. Great for camouflage purposes. But once it was fired, it gave himself away. And we got by them. I think we lost a couple of tanks then. I know we were with an infantry platoon, They got in, I don't know why in the hell, they got off the road somehow, and this little track we were following, and tried to go up through a field, and they were blowing sky high. There were three or four of them, these carriers, from the North Nova Scotia regiment. Just sky high. You never saw anything like it in your life. Then we got to our rendezvous, but the infantry arrived at about the same time, or immediately after us. And then some of our training in England then came into the fore. Each tank carried a section of infantry on its back. So this was to speed the process of going inland towards Caen as fast as we could. So the two brigades had created their little bridgehead, which was about a mile and a half deep, maybe 2 miles. And then we went through the bridgehead with this battalion of infantry, the North Nova Scotians, on our back. And we got in about 5 miles. And we had an awful time getting in. The Germans by then had recovered, and their reserve battalions and regiments, 12th SS regiments located in the Caen area, of course, then came forward to meet us. And from then on, it was a real dogfight. From about midnight on the 6th of June, for 4 or 5 days, it was a real business.
Okay, you were mentioning that the night of D-Day was a long one.
Yes, we got as far as a little village of Buisson, I recall, and we had with us the North Nova Scotians on the backs of our tanks. They disembarked, and we decided that we would harbor there, lager there for the night. And during the night, we were attacked by the Germans. But the infantry managed to repel them, so that it was a sleepless night. The next morning, right at dawn, our attack resumed, and we were with the idea of going directly to the airport at Carpiquet, which was the main airport which catered to the city of Caen. And we got as far as, one squadron got as far as Oti, and another squadron got as far as Buron. And then we ran into, it seemed to me from, I can recall seeing on the horizon sort of, looked to me like 100 ready German tanks. And they were flanking us a little bit around to our left, and which was very, very frightening. And anyway, we lost that day. I think we lost something like 27 tanks altogether in the engagements. I lost a tank personally, and had to get out of that and get into another one, which was, of course, the troop leader's job.
Tell me about that. What happened there?
Well, just that you're